It's the MPR News Update, the Minnesota News podcast for Friday, March 27. I'm Phil Picardi. Coming up, St. Cloud school officials deal with racial difficulties. One man makes the case for hemp. How union organizing might be getting easier. Let's play hockey, college hockey, and more sounds and voices. First, Democrats in the Minnesota Senate released a budget outline today that would spend nearly $43 billion over the next 2 years and provide more than $200 million in tax cuts. They described their proposal as charting the middle ground between DFL Governor Mark Dayton and House Republicans. But most of the numbers track closer to Dayton. DFL Senate Majority Leader Tom Bach of Cook says almost half of the projected $1.9 billion budget surplus would be spent on public schools and colleges and universities. He says Senate plans also put $250 million into the state's rainy day account.
Everyone would like to spend more money. Everybody would like to have a tax cut. But really, the state budget is critically important to the delivery of all the services that our state and local governments provide, and making sure that that stability is there going forward is just really, really critical.
The Senate DFL tax relief number is similar to the governor's, but far smaller than House Republicans, who are proposing $2 billion in tax cuts. Bach says more restraint is needed to avoid repeating fiscal mistakes of the past. Healthcare quality for Minnesotans enrolled in public assistance programs continues to lag behind those with private health insurance. But there were improvements last year in managing diabetes and vascular diseases. Mark Zedeklik reports.
The report for the Minnesota Department of Human Services is based on 12 quality measures. Results for people enrolled in public health programs were significantly lower than the broader population in 10 of the 12 categories. The biggest gaps involved colorectal and breast cancer screening and adult asthma care. But care for people with vascular diseases improved 9% compared to 2013. Diabetes care was 7% better. DHS Commissioner Lucinda Jessen says significant work remains to close the quality gap. Mark Zedeklik, Minnesota Public Radio News.
The Archdiocese of St. Paul in Minneapolis wants more time to file a bankruptcy reorganization plan. Martin Moylan has more.
The Archdiocese is asking the judge overseeing its bankruptcy to give the church until November 30th to file a plan and until January of next year to gain creditor acceptance of it. The Archdiocese has been in mediation with creditors, sex abuse victims, insurers, and other parties trying to work out a deal. But the church says it will need more time if it's to wrestle a possible contribution from insurers that could help compensate abuse victims. Without an extension, the Archdiocese would have until mid-May to file a reorganization plan before any other party could. A hearing on the request will be held early next month. Martin Moylan, Minnesota Public Radio News.
The Minnesota Vikings are chipping in nearly $20 million more to their stadium in Minneapolis. Tim Nelson tells us why.
The money will put the team's total contribution over $550 million, or 52% of the total project budget. It's the ninth time they've chipped in for more bells and whistles on the stadium, including food service, seating, display boards, and even bathroom improvements among the added amenities. The new cash has amounted to more than $73 million, according to the Vikings. Team President Mark Wilf said the Vikings want to give fans the best experience possible. The Vikings have had to pay for any add-ons for the stadium. Under construction for more than 15 months, it's scheduled to open next summer. The state of Minnesota and city of Minneapolis are not allowed by law to increase their contributions. Tim Nelson, Minnesota Public Radio News.
A Colorado biofuels company pioneering new technology in Minnesota is still losing money, but its finances are improving, so says Mark Stile.
Gevo's main plant is in the southwest Minnesota community of Laverne, where it makes both ethanol and the industrial chemical isobutanol from corn. The company says it lost about $11 million in the fourth quarter of 2014. That's an improvement from a $17 million loss the year before. The company makes mainly ethanol at Laverne, but is looking to expand isobutanol production there if it can find partners who will help finance the expansion. Isobutanol potentially offers better profit margins than ethanol. It can be used as a fuel, but also has wide applications in the chemical industry. Mark Stile, Minnesota Public Radio News, Worthington.
Officials with the St. Cloud School District say they have a plan to address allegations of racial discrimination made by Somali students. Last week, a few dozen mostly Somali students walked out of a St. Cloud high school in protest of what they called harassment by non-Somali students. District officials say they are in the beginning stages of calming tensions. Brant Williams has more.
The first step is talking. That's what St. Cloud Area School District Superintendent Willie Jett says administrators, staff, and students are doing now. He says even though discussions about race and culture are complex, the district is committed to making sure they take place.
And so we started some of those kind of conversations last week a little bit, started some of it this week. And then the biggest thing for us is how to schedule that in the future and make it part of our practice.
Jett and school board chair Dennis Whipple also opened a dialogue with a group of Somali community leaders earlier this week. Jett called the discussion productive, and he says leaders expressed several main concerns, including the need for more teachers of color, addressing bullying, establishing better lines of communication between school officials and the community, and concerns that Somali students are being unfairly singled out for harsher discipline.
When you look at suspension data, it naturally points to students of color, Somali students, being disproportionate in terms of suspension rate. And so they were looking at, okay, can we analyze that? Can we look at that? Can we look at what our practices are? As it relates to suspensions.
Jett says school officials will take a look at what parents and students recommend and possibly turn them into policy changes down the road. Hassan Youssef is the chair of the task force, which met with school district officials this week. A former candidate for the St. Cloud School Board, Youssef has lived in St. Cloud since 2001. He says the top priority for the task force is diversifying school staff and better training to help staff relate to Somali students.
Mostly we are looking for the training because the people who are working there, they are not bad people. They are very competent, actually. But it is cultural misunderstanding and not aware of the right of others. All this bring in things which are not good.
Senior Nastaho Dini says she organized last week's walkout because the district didn't immediately respond to a Snapchat photo taken by a classmate and captioned to suggest that a Somali student was a member of a terrorist group. Dini says that was just one instance of harassment that school officials seemed reluctant to address.
They said that they already know that we're not being treated equally. I mean, if you already know, then can you please do something about it? Because we're being harassed every single day.
This is not the first time St. Cloud school officials have had to address allegations of anti-Somali sentiments in the schools. After a complaint was filed with the Federal Civil Rights Department of similar activity 7 years ago, the department recommended several policy changes for the district to complete before 2012. Brant Williams, Minnesota Public Radio News, St. Cloud.
A bill that would allow for expanded research on hemp in Minnesota is advancing through the Minnesota House and Senate. As it stands, research on the plant is tightly regulated by the U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration. George Weiblin is a plant biology professor at the University of Minnesota. He's one of few researchers in the country with federal permission to study hemp. And he talked with Kathy Werzer on Morning Edition.
What's the difference between hemp and marijuana?
Hemp and marijuana are distinguished on the basis of their drug content, the psychoactive ingredient in marijuana being THC or tetrahydrocannabinol. And marijuana has a greater concentration of that drug than does industrial hemp.
So what are you looking at here? What's your research focused on?
Well, since 2002, when I received a research registration from the DEA, we've been studying the genetic basis of drug content in the plant cannabis in order to understand how hemp and marijuana differ.
And I know and understand that the process is pretty difficult to go through, to have to grow and then research hemp. Give me an idea of how tough it is.
Well, as far as I know, there are only two university researchers in the United States who have the permission that that I do. And it takes years, step by step, to obtain the research registration. I would say it's virtually impossible to do the work that we've tried to do over the last 10 years.
Mm. What would this proposed legislation attempt to change then?
Well, the Federal Farm Bill of 2014 included a provision that, for the first time, defines hemp as different from marijuana, exempting it from regulation under the Controlled Substances Act for the purpose of research on developing hemp as a crop for U.S. farmers.
I can see why the federal government might be a little bit shy about doing something like this, because I presume then they're thinking it might get into other hands, I would suppose.
Well, there is much confusion surrounding the difference between hemp and marijuana, because they do belong to the same species. But 20 states have already enacted legislation that permits institutions of higher learning and state departments of agriculture to study the hemp plant, as it has many economic benefits, such as fiber production, and particularly now the market in seed, which is highly nutritious and rich in oil that can be used in cosmetics and a number of applications.
You help me out here, Professor. I was thinking back. I believe there was a similar proposal last year that didn't really go anywhere in the House and Senate. What are you seeing this year? Do you have optimism that this could pass?
Well, I'm more optimistic than ever, considering that bills have been making their way through House and Senate with little opposition, and the concerns that have been raised are being addressed through revisions to the bill. And considering that we now have a federal act that clarifies the difference between hemp and marijuana, that makes it now possible for Minnesota to get in line with the other states that already have such legislation. We happen to have, thanks to my research, a 12-year head start on understanding this plant and developing it as a crop alternative for Minnesota farmers.
It seems like you have to battle a lot of misperceptions.
That's true. There are passionate convictions held about the cannabis plant on all sides of the issue.
So if this actually passes, how fast then can your research pick up steam?
Well, the bill will charge the Minnesota Department of Agriculture with developing rules that will regulate how research is done in Minnesota. And so it will then be in the state's hands. And presumably we can proceed much more quickly than I've been able to proceed. Just for example, I've been waiting 2 years for federal permission to go out and collect feral hemp seed in Minnesota, commonly known as ditchweed.
All right, Professor, we'll keep following the situation. Thank you much.
You're very welcome. Thank you, Kathy.
George Weiblin and Kathy Werzer on Morning Edition. New federal rules set to take effect next month could make union organizing easier, but business groups are suing to block the new rules, saying they give organized labor the upper hand. Here's Matt Sepik.
Last summer, the Service Employees International Union won the biggest victory in decades for Minnesota's labor movement when it won the right to represent 27,000 home health workers across the state. Today, SEIU healthcare organizer Eric Salmanen is focusing his efforts on unionizing workers in hospitals and nursing homes. New rules from the National Labor Relations Board could make Salmanen's job easier. Among other things, they delay most employer challenges to a union election petition until after workers have actually voted on joining a union. Salmanen says that'll make it harder for employers to file what he says are frivolous claims.
It's very common for management to try to tie the whole process up and file a lot of different objections, even if none of them go through, which can hold off an election by months, sometimes years.
Another key change is that employers have just 7 days to file paperwork with the NLRB outlining any objections to a unionization request from workers. Management must also send the board a list of employees eligible to vote in a union election, including their job classifications and work locations. The NLRB says the rules are meant to streamline the process and make it more consistent. Under the old system, the agency says neither unions nor management could predict when a vote to unionize would be held because individual NLRB offices handled things differently. Marlon Ostis oversees union elections across the Upper Midwest as the National Labor Relations Board's Minneapolis-based regional director. Ostis says the changes are the most significant he's seen in his 38 years at the agency, and he says they'll speed up the process of scheduling a vote in cases where someone seeks union representation.
We're going to have to focus on representation cases when they come in much more quickly, get the parties to focus on them right after they're filed, and hopefully reach election agreements in terms of when elections will be held and who will be voting, And all that's going to be more compressed.
With union membership on the decline for decades, labor groups like the expedited process. But Jim Plunkett with the U.S. Chamber of Commerce says it allows unions to hold what he calls ambush elections. Today, the NLRB says unionization votes are held a median 38 days after workers file a petition. Plunkett, who's director of labor policy for the business lobbying group, says with the new rules, those votes could come in less than 2 weeks. And he says that's not nearly enough time for employers to respond and make their case to workers.
The rule here really is a solution in search of a problem and would dramatically tilt the playing field, and what we think should be a neutral playing field would tilt it dramatically in favor of union organizers.
Plunkett says small employers without HR departments and labor lawyers would be at a particular disadvantage. John Remington, a University of Minnesota labor relations expert, says expedited elections might boost unions' chances of winning a vote, but Remington says don't expect a surge of organizing.
This is not a silver bullet for the survival of the labor movement.
Remington says the new union election regulations came at the behest of the Democratic majority on the National Labor Relations Board. He says things could change easily if more Republicans are appointed.
I wouldn't be surprised if a Republican administration appointed a board majority that would attempt to overturn a lot of these things very dramatically.
The new union election rules are scheduled to take effect April 14th, but they face a more immediate challenge. The U.S. Chamber of Commerce and several other business organizations have filed federal lawsuits seeking to block the regulations. Matt Sepik, Minnesota Public Radio News, Minneapolis.
The NCAA men's hockey tournament begins today, and five of the 16 teams competing are from our region. Kathy Werzer talked puck with Howard Sinker, a digital sports editor of the Star Tribune.
This seems a little weird to have this many teams from our area in the tournament. Am I right about that?
Well, it's a little unusual, Kathy, but I think it really shows the strength of hockey in Minnesota this season. Remember, the Minnesota and Minnesota Duluth were the Division I programs in the state, and now you have a state full of top-level hockey, and for the purposes of the tournament, we're even going to include North Dakota as pretty much of a Minnesota school, even though that makes some people cringe.
Well, they're close enough, I guess. Now, I'm going to be watching the first round today because that game pits the Gophers against the Bulldogs.
Right. It's the Minnesota-Minnesota Duluth rivalry transplanted to New Hampshire for the day. And it's one of those situations where, yeah, the Bulldogs have won 3 out of 4 games against what we'll call the Big U this season. But I think UMD, no matter how good it might be, would always see themselves as the underdog in this situation.
But neither the U of M or UMD are the top seeds in the tournament.
No. And in fact, Minnesota really was kind of on the back edge of qualifying. The top two seeds in the tournament are Minnesota State Mankato, which is playing Rochester Institute of Technology in Indiana, and the number two seed is North Dakota, and they're playing in Fargo today in a region that also includes St. Cloud State.
Wow. Okay, so how good is Minnesota State Mankato?
Minnesota State Mankato is probably top to bottom the most solid team in the country. They've been ranked. Not only are they the top seed in the tournament, but I think people would say they're really the elite team. They didn't get probably as much notice as the other teams because they're the only representative from the only Minnesota representative from the WCHA in the tournament. The three other schools other than Minnesota all are part of the Northern Collegiate Hockey Conference, which was one of the spinoffs that happened when the Big Ten decided to have its own hockey conference.
Let's talk about North Dakota.
North Dakota is led really by its goalie, Zane McIntyre from Thief River Falls. And it's like the Gophers with their goalie, Adam Wilcox. If one of them is really, really hot, they could carry the team no matter what happens. North Dakota is really worthy of watching for that reason. Goaltending could carry them through very, very far. And that doesn't mean to diminish the rest of the team. The number two seeding in the tournament isn't a freak at all. It's just something to look out for if you're not somebody who follows college hockey for most of the season.
Anything else you're going to be looking for in the tournament?
I'm going to be looking to see, really, with the Gophers, several of their seniors came back this season instead of turning pro specifically to have one more shot at a national title. And it'll be after the struggles of midseason. The team has really been playing much better lately. I think everybody's really focused on the problems they've had. But the tournament really gives the University of Minnesota ball teams a chance to sneak up on the rest of the field.
All right, Mr. Sinker, we will talk to you later. Have a great weekend.
It'll be a fun weekend of hockey, Kathy.
That's Werzer and Sinker this morning on ME. We finished the week with a new Minnesota Sounds and Voices. Tom Cran from All Things Considered has the intro.
Ha-ha, everyone.
Ha-ha.
Take that, Parkinson's.
Take that, Parkinson's.
Nice job.
Parkinson's disease is no laughing matter. The degenerative condition attacks the nervous system. Yet music therapist Sandy Holton encourages her patients to laugh and help loosen stiff muscles, a Parkinson's symptom. And Holton says music helps people with Parkinson's keep the rhythm they need for walking.
Our motor system, right away, immediately, hooks into that. And it's happening in a part of our brain that is not affected by Parkinson's.
Dan Olson talks to Holton about her work in a new episode of Minnesota Sounds and Voices.
It's great. You can just go ahead and start walking.
Sandy Holton is putting Art Grell through his paces. Grell's gait is close to a shuffle. His stiff legs move slowly.
Okay, so I want to work on the foot clearance. So what I want you to do is to hit the... with your knees, hit these drums, okay?
Holton asks a seated Grell to hit paddles in time with music. She wants him to twist, loosen up, get his body moving.
A person with Parkinson's has rigidity throughout their body. That's one of the primary symptoms, including in their trunk.
Art Grell is a patient at the Struthers Parkinson Center in Golden Valley, a nationally recognized treatment facility. There's no cure for Parkinson's. The speech, physical and music therapy at Struthers, and medication treat the symptoms. The symptoms can include tremors, a weakened voice, and what some call mental apathy. Grell says sessions with Holton lift his spirits.
I think the music gets me going more, gets me more excited.
Music therapy expanded after World War II. It helped military veterans cope with post-traumatic stress disorder.
Sing it like you mean it.
Oh, beautiful for space.
Holton's specialty is people with Parkinson's. A Robbinsdale native, Holton's Bachelor of Science in Music Therapy is from Augsburg College. She's done additional study at the Center for Biomedical Research in Music in Colorado. Holton is a gifted musician who dropped out of piano lessons in grade school, telling her mother music wasn't going to be a big part of her life.
She liked to rub my nose in that a little bit because I am doing something with music.
Once a week, patients gather at the Struthers Parkinson Center for a community chorus. Sandy Holton says the singing boosts morale and loosens rigid bodies.
That affects those muscles that are around all of the articulation, and so doing those sorts of exercises helps to improve the total voice function.
77-year-old Bill Schaefer says the exercise helps, and he enjoys the support of being with others.
My voice today was down. I was down. And just her attitude is really terrific, and it means a lot.
Parkinson's erodes many physical and some mental functions, but many with the condition retain an active mind as their body declines. Holton admires their courage.
That they're able to face this with hope is something that is incredibly inspiring, and truly, they are my heroes.
Shall we?
That's Sandy Holton. She's a music therapist at Struthers Parkinson Center in Golden Valley. Dan Olson is our Minnesota Sounds and Voices reporter. And I'm Phil Picardi, your Morning Edition host next Monday and Tuesday. So we'll have someone else doing the podcast. But tune in for all the Monday news right here on the NPR News Update.